All right, we have looked at the 19th century as a series of responses to Hume and Kant. Hume's skepticism and Kant's answer to that skepticism, where we lose certainty and objectivity, because the human mind is the only way we can conceptualize reality in a rational, scientific way, and therefore we can't ever be sure of what ultimate reality is. That conundrum of problems with which we entered the 19th century, I said, is responded to in three ways. One is the route of rationalism in the idealistic sense. Hegel's rationalism, that is to say, a super rationality, a new kind of logic that will now get us to what ultimate reality is. The second response to Kant and the lack of certainty that we have because of Hume's skepticism and Kant's phenomenal noumenal distinction is to say there's an alternative access to ultimate reality. And then we're not going to get to it today, but the third major response to Kant is to reassert a rationalism of the phenomenal sort. So I'll call it phenomenalism. Those who say, well, what Kant called the phenomena is all that we have access to rationally anyway. So you have materialism and scientism, positivism, or in the broader sense, a phenomenalistic approach. So you got the rational approach of Hegel, number one. On the other side, you have the rational approach, the phenomenalistic rational approach of the materialist and the scientist. I don't mean those who are scientists, but all the scientism. And then right now what we're studying are the fellows who take an alternative access way of dealing with ultimate reality. And the first alternative access that we looked at is Schopenhauer, is voluntarism and mysticism. So now I just want to make sure you know what we're moving into. The second alternative access approach that we're going to look at is Romanticism. And then I'm moving toward dealing with subjective individualism in Soren Kierkegaard. And then we'll look finally at nihilism with Nietzsche. Okay, you all understand where we are? We're in the alternative access room now. We've looked at one piece of furniture, voluntarism. The second option in terms of alternative access to ultimate reality is known as Romanticism. Romanticism dominated Europe from the end of the 18th century through the first half of the 19th century, although, you know, no one woke up one day and said, okay, that's the end of the Romantic Age, and went on, but roughly the end of the 18th century to the middle of the 19th century. Romanticism is a broad mindset which is reflected in philosophy, in the arts, in literature, history, and political theory. We're doing the history of philosophy and broadly culture. You need to understand that Romanticism was not just the school of philosophy, it was much broader than that and affected especially the arts and literature, and then history and political theory as well. In literature, Romanticism is set over against neoclassicism. Neoclassicism. Now, what is neoclassicism? Well, the very terminology tells you, right? It's a revival of the classical outlook on literature and art. And the classics take us back to what? Ancient Greece. the neoclassical period is a revival of the outlook of ancient Greece. And so neoclassicism would be associated with what period of philosophy and culture in Western history? What we call the Renaissance. Very good. Because the Renaissance is what? A revival of the humanistic outlook of the ancient Greek world. So neoclassicism in literature is the Renaissance approach, or that is going back to the ancient Greeks. Neoclassicism is an effort to attain restraint, polish, and objectivity in literature. You want this in your notes, because you're going to have to get a feeling for the difference between Romanticism and neoclassicism. Neoclassicism is an effort to attain restraint, polish, and objectivity in literature. That is, there's a sense of correctness about doing your poetry and producing your literary works. Neoclassicism is characterized by regulation, fixed standards, and what we might call protocol or decorum. And the focus of neoclassical literature when it comes to characters is on types of characters. You look for character type, the hero, the tragic hero, whatever it may be. Romanticism, as I said, is a reaction against neoclassicism. So it shows less restraint and more spontaneity and caprice. It shows a wider scope than would have been considered in a neoclassical work. That is, Romanticism endorses and uses topics and styles of literature which are contrary to protocol. So a neoclassical work would never take up something on incest, let's say, whereas the Romantics would, you know, nothing is verboten here. You can write about anything and in all kinds of styles, not regulated polished styles, but all kinds of styles of expression. And the basic point of Romantic literature is to focus on the individuality of characters rather than character types. The individuality, the idiosyncratic nature of the character, the uniqueness, the personality of the character rather than the type or typical aspect of the character. In Romantic literature, as you might have guessed, sentiment is very prominent. The literature tends to be sentimental. And often the romantic hero is a rebel, right? Now, just from what I've told you so far, maybe I can just be done with the lecture on romanticism. Can you get the point? Contemporary culture in America, is it closer to neoclassicism or romanticism? Well, yeah, I mean, sentiment, feeling, you know, unique idiosyncratic characters, no topic, you know, is out of bounds and so forth. Romanticism is especially evident in lyric poetry because of its direct personal expressiveness, lyric poetry. And so the romantic poets that are well known, you should all be able to identify these men, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Byron, Shelley, Keats, Poe, Cooper, Washington Irving, Hawthorne, Longfellow, and Emerson. The English ones, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Byron, Shelley, Keats, the Americans, Cooper, Irving, Hawthorne, Poe, Longfellow, and Emerson. Well-known romantic poets. Continental romantic poets, names that you should be able to identify, Goethe, G-O-E-T-H-E, the German, Goethe, Heine, H-E-I-N-E, Victor Hugo, and in Russia, Pushkin, I mentioned Victor Hugo. How has Victor Hugo been popularized in the last decade? Maybe the biggest musical productions in popular theater. Les Miserables, that's right. On Shelley, I do want you to note that you have an assigned reading assignment on Shelley in Paul Johnson's book, Chapter 2. Okay. It'd be nice if you could read about all of them. In fact, in reading about Shelley, you'll learn something about Byron and others, too. But if you want to talk about one scourge of humanity, learn about the life of Shelley. Make that stop. I mean, that should give you a little pause when you think about this emphasis on romanticism. I mean, it looks real good. Well, when the lifestyle that goes with it reflects that kind of lack of decorum, lack of standards, lack of objectivity, hey, may not be the sort of thing you really want. Okay, romanticism, back to my introductory remarks, is a broad mindset. It's seen in philosophy, the arts. We've just talked about literature, history, and political theory. Broadly, what is romanticism? It's mainly a reaction against rationalism, a reaction against the Enlightenment, and against its conception of knowledge. The emphasis in romanticism is upon imagination and emotion, not on reason and formal criteria. Imagination and emotion rather than reason and formal criteria. The German philosopher Schlegel, S-C-H-L-E-G-E-L, Schlegel defined romanticism as the spirit of subjectivity. The spirit of subjectivity. And that, by the way, is the reason in my outline I include Kierkegaard in this category. Because the great emphasis in Kierkegaard is on the subject, the individual, and the subjectivity of the subject. He may not have been a romantic in other ways, but Kierkegaard certainly fit into this definition, the spirit of subjectivity. Characteristics of the romantic mindset, well, an obvious one is focus on and a celebration of the self and individuality. Another characteristic is respect for what we might call the supra-sensuous reality. Supra, that which goes beyond. There is a reality that goes beyond what we sense. And that reality is bigger and richer and more exciting and more unified than anything the Enlightenment conceived. As you know, the Enlightenment view of the world is you have separate minds that are engaged in relationships with separate objects, and you have all these discrete realities out there, all these individuals. The romantic mindset is, again, unified by a general distrust of that view and an affirmation that reality is unified and it's beyond our appearance, our sensuous experience of individuals. It's bigger and richer and more exciting than anything you might have imagined. Thirdly, the Romantics laid stress on the power of imagination and intuition over against reasoning. That is direct feeling and emotion. Go out there and experience the world. Stop and smell the roses. And fourthly, in one way or another, the Romantics all tended to put a high value, maybe a supreme value, on art. Supreme value placed on art. Let's relate this mindset to Kant and then look at a series of romantic writers. The romantics would have thought that Kant was correct in this, that science and reason are incompetent to give us the ultimate truth of reality. And that there is a realm of ultimate reality that's beyond the phenomenal. So the Romantics would have said, you're right, Kant. Reason and science are incompetent to get us to the ultimate reality, and there is an ultimate reality beyond the phenomenal. Set that in contrast to the scientistic outlook that says there isn't anything beyond the phenomenal. Kant was wrong about that. The Romantics would say Kant was right that reason and science are incompetent, but he was also right that there is a reality beyond that. Kant was wrong to say we can't know that reality. He was wrong to be agnostic about it. According to the Romanticists, ultimate reality is too sublime for conceptual analysis. Too sublime for rational conceptual analysis. It's rather accessible in direct experience, accessible in feeling and intuition and emotion, or if you will, contemplation. So we see two things here in the Romantic. I'm just overgeneralizing here so you get a sense of what we're talking about, what this beast is. Two things: a hostility to reason, and secondly, a view that reality, which is beyond what reason can tell you, is impressively immense and very sublime. Ultimate reality is immense and sublime. Hostility to reason. Reason is nothing but a false secondary power by which we multiply distinctions, as Wordsworth put it. Reason is a false secondary power by which we multiply distinctions and artificially impose them on the living whole of reality and thereby destroy our experience of reality. Now, who's already said this? Well, that's very much like Schopenhauer. Reason is a false secondary power by which we multiply distinctions. That's the end of Wordsworth's quote. And these distinctions are artificially imposed on and destroy the living whole of reality. And so the Romantics wanted to turn from scholarship and attend to nature, passively letting it work on us directly in contemplation and communion. They wanted to turn from scholarship, rationality, and attend to nature by passively letting it work on us in a direct way, either in contemplation or communion. And in that sense, the Romantics felt that in terms of awareness of ultimate reality, there's really a continuum that runs from the animal world through infants, children, dreams, and adult thinking, or adult experience. Animals have a direct experience of that sublime reality. Infants do, even better than adults. Children do. We experience it in our dream life, and we even have an adult awareness of it. The interesting thing is, this may not be the way you would have thought, you know what the highest on that continuum is? The animal world. The animals have the best direct, you know, apprehension of ultimate reality. Second best, infants. So the Romantics are characterized by what? Wanting to get back to being more like the animals and like children. Endorsing our dreams is not just some kind of throwaway experience that you have at night, but you're in touch with that sublime, immense reality that goes beyond. According to the Romantics, reason leads us to take an attitude of neutrality, an objective weighing of evidence. And that is not as important, it's not as valuable as an empathetic involvement and commitment. And so the model of the rational professor is not appealing to a Romantic. Give me the man of passion. Give me the man of commitment, the man of involvement, the one who's in touch with his feelings. And once again, I ask you, what is our culture characterized by? It's almost laughable once you realize what the background to it all is, you know, the sensitive individual, right? He's in touch with his feelings. he's one with the world round about him and so forth. What a joke. Well, I mean, there's something to this. These people don't say this without there being some reality, but reason is thrown out the window and derogated. And then, as I said, reality is impressively immense. Reality is sublime to the romantic. It's so immense, so sublime, that it baffles science. The scientist can't ever get... Let the scientist do his little, you know, analysis of light or of water or what have you. That's nothing to the comparison of having the sun shine on you when you're in this wonderful lake. That experience puts you in contact with the sublime reality much better than what science is. Science is baffled by ultimate reality. Moreover, reality is so immense and sublime that the whole finite human enterprise is trivial. Man now loses himself in the greater whole. You know, we really are just specks. Can Christians appreciate this? What does Psalm 8 say? What is man that thou art mindful of? Man is trivial. The human enterprise is petty by comparison to the ultimate reality. Of course, what have the romantics done? They've got the idolatry that nature is the ultimate reality rather than God. But nevertheless, they have that formal parallel that they see the finiteness of human enterprises and experience as being petty. According to the romantics, man is not unique, as the Enlightenment thought he was. Man is the great rational animal. Man is not unique. Man is just part of the greater whole of nature. And in fact, unlike the Enlightenment that saw man and things as sharply distinct individuals that exist in the world, the Romantics saw the universe as one continuous, living, dynamic being. Let me say that again. One continuous, living, dynamic being. Okay, these introductory remarks have been given to you just to enable you to generalize and get an overview of what we mean by the romantic mindset. I want to look at some particular romantics, and I'm just going to be kind of plowing through this quickly. We've done enough stopping and analyzing of Hegel and Schopenhauer that if you understand the general romantic mindset, this will just give you a little bit of detail, some meat to put on the skeleton. I want to look at Goethe, the German, Schiller, Schelling, Schlegel, Coleridge, and Schleiermacher. You love all those Germans, right? Schiller, Schelling, Schlegel, Schleiermacher. If you can learn to say that, you know, 10 times fast without getting your tongue tied, then you will get a higher grade in this class. First of all, Goethe. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, 1749 to 1832. Goethe was a German poet, a writer, and a scientist. He produced works in optics, on plant life, and on theory of color. He was also a public administrator, quite a Renaissance man, really, the Leonardo of his age, I guess. A poet, a writer, a scientist, and he was also a public administrator, working in the court of the Duke of Weimar. His work on plant life anticipated Darwin. His work on the theory of colors opposed Newton. Now, I'm not taking sides in any of that, but I just want you to know something about the grandeur of Goethe's contribution. I mean, here's somebody who could argue with a great scientist like Newton, could anticipate the creativity and outlook of a Darwin, could be a court official, a leading poet and writer, quite a man. He studied law at Leipzig. And during a medical leave from his studies, he got sick, he went through a phase of Christian pietism, which he eventually overthrew, but nevertheless you should know that he had an early experience. Pietism, since you haven't gone through church history, I should mention to you, pietism doesn't simply mean an emphasis on piety. Pietism is a derogation of creedal Christianity. We don't need creeds. Doctrine's not what's important. What is important is